Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
Oh hi, hello nerds. Happy end of 2020. The worst year in generations. This is Let's Talk About Myths, baby. And I am Liv, your supremely nerdy host, here with a fun and fascinating end to 2020. Today's episode, much like last week, is dedicated to a very real person from ancient Greek history who has quite the mythology built around him, Alexander the Great. A quick note, similar with the last episode I released, I've been using something to record conversations and it sucks. I'm not going to use it again, but we just have to deal with it now because I don't have extensive editing skills. They are primitive, to say the least. So let's all just get past the audio quality and listen to the conversation. I spoke with Meg Finlayson, who is an Alexander expert that I know from Twitter, about the man, the myth, and the movie. Yes, we talked about Oliver Stone's mid-2000s epic, if you want to use that word. This episode doesn't really require you to have watched that movie. It would help. It's 3 hours long, though, so I wouldn't do that to you. Essentially, we just talked about the history of Alexander, the mythology of Alexander in relation to the movie. So it's fascinating regardless, just all about that man who was such a huge part of ancient Greek history for really such a short amount of time. There is a reason he is called Alexander the Great. Dude has quite the story, quite the mythology, quite the Colin Farrell not even trying to do a reasonable accent. But for real, the movie, if you want to see it or don't, definitely has some fine qualities when it comes to historical accuracy and overall filmmaking, but is also hugely problematic. It was made at the same time as Troy and 300, though, so it's in good company. This is episode 106, Alexander the Great, the man, the myth, and the movie. Meg, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about one of my favorite things in the world, which is the Alexander film. My name's Meg. I've just completed my MLit in Classics from the University of St. Andrews. So I've just completed all my master's studies now. I'm currently in the process of applying for further education, PhDs and things like that. But at the moment, I'm sort of like an independent researcher, I suppose. I kind of do everything in my spare time. A lot of my research interests are in classical reception, so in media, film, TV, that kind of thing. And a lot of my research is centered around Alexander the Great, his life, his legacy, and a lot to do with him in reception. And hopefully my future thesis, fingers crossed, will be related to Alexander reception in the 20th century, particularly queer reception and sort of the liminality of his character, particularly in this kind of divisive 20th century where you see a lot of his traditional mannerisms start to change in secondary scholarship, and we get kind of the emergence of this queer figure in Alexander the Great. So that's hopefully the direction that I want to head into.
That's fascinating. I don't have my master's, notoriously. I just have a BA, so I didn't cover too much. I think that, you know, when it comes to those like undergrad classes, Alexander is a big part, but not, I don't even think they had like a whole class on him. So I feel like somehow for me, he gets kind of lost, even though that seems so impossible given how important he was mm-hmm. to the ancient Greek world. So I'm so excited to talk to you about this, specifically about the movie too, because the movie is so interesting and long.
Yeah, I try and talk about it and people just don't hear it. It's like everyone's blocked it out and I'm like, no, please, it's so interesting.
I just, even seeing your notes on this, it seems to me that Alexander is your Fellowship of the Ring to me, like the extensive way you know it and can quote it and everything. And I was just feeling that pretty deeply. I was like, oh, this is my Lord of the Rings. Like, I get this. Like, I understand you.
I just want to note that I didn't take all of the paraphrasing. I didn't remember that off the top of my head. Some of that was like copy and paste. But I did earlier in the year, I wrote a paper on Alexander and particularly like gender and masculinity in the film. And for that, I did have to watch it and then go back and write out my own like little transcripts of sections. And oh my gosh.
Wow. Yeah, that, I mean, I saw the movie when it first came out, which I think it's like 2005.
Well, there's so many versions. I think the original theatrical release was 2004, but then since then there's been like two or three re-releases.
So really?
Yeah, because the original, I think, is a lot shorter, but I think I was a bit mean and requested that we talk about the 3.5 hour long version. Potentially as recent as 2012, I think, possibly. There's the original theatrical cut, there's a director's cut, and there's an ultimate cut.
Oh my god.
And they're all slightly different, but the ultimate cut, 3.5 hour, has got all of the stuff that they filmed and edited, whereas the original one's like taken out a lot of things.
Wow. Well, I'll admit, I only watched whatever was available on Apple. So what, I don't know what version that was, but I watched it. But I did watch it in the theater when it first came out, I think, because I've been a nerd forever. But I'm pretty sure that that's the only time I saw it before just watching it again last week. So it was quite the thing to watch again when I hadn't seen it. And it is such an interesting take on, I think, on ancient Greece as a whole is kind of what I saw most, just because I'm not super familiar with Alexander. So for me, I was just kind of like, this is an interesting take on just Greece.
It comes like right in the middle of this like swords and sandals resurgence. So you have like Gladiator, which was, I don't know, 2001 maybe. And then you have Alexander, which comes out, and Troy as well, I think, might have come out in the same year or perhaps the year after. And then the year after that, there's 300. So this kind of early to mid noughties is where you get all these like really big, like blockbuster, like swords and sandals resurgence films. And they're also interesting to look at with hindsight because they seem so dated. Now you look back and you're like, wow, that was only 15 years ago. And yet people were still making films like this. So it comes at a kind of an interesting point in just that area.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, the timeline of it, because you're right, Troy was also 2004. See, for me, this was like high school. So I think that I had it, I think that it just like fed into how much I already loved all of these ancient cultures, because 2004, I was like 15, 16, and so like watching it in the theater, and then would watch Alexander and Troy. And then I remember exactly when 300 came out, my roommate almost had me name my cat after Leonidas because of how big 300 was when it came out. And yeah, I hadn't ever thought of just like that whole time period. We did really get so many ancient adaptations.
Yeah, they really were just kind of going for what was big at the time. And then I suppose it's really dropped off the radar because in hindsight, nobody likes them anymore. I think maybe Gladiator kind of still sticks out as being good.
And I will watch Troy forever. And then I will bitch about Achilles and Patroclus being cousins forever.
Yeah, they're just so interesting. I love like classics misinformations. I find them so interesting how they get to be there. So even if like the things in Alexander aren't like necessarily correct, or it strikes me as weird, I kind of like to investigate, well, why did they make that decision? Because somebody had to make that decision. Is it just pure misinformation, or is it something to do with classical reception and how we kind of consume and edit ancient myth to sort ourselves in like modernity? So that's why I love films that are just weird, because I like to try and work out why they are that way.
I love that. I want to talk all about that, but first, why don't you give us a quick rundown of Alexander the Great in general, historically more so than the movie?
Alexander's interesting because he's this guy that everyone's kind of heard about, at least in passing, I think. Maybe I'm biased because that's my whole niche, but I tend to think that most people know the name and kind of think, oh, he was a Greek guy and he conquered the world and he was great. And that's a really good foundation, because that's kind of what a lot of our sources get at. But to put him in a little bit more of a context, I suppose. So he was born in 356 BCE to Philip II of Macedon, who was his father, and his mother, Olympias of Epirus. So he was born about 100 years after the Persian Wars, about 100 years after the sort of the height of the classical Greek world. So at this point, Athens and Sparta have kind of been in a period of decline, and there really isn't kind of a preeminent power in the Greek world except for Macedon, which was it was really mostly under Alexander's father, Philip II, who brought Macedon into the forefront as being the most powerful Greek state at the time, which gets overshadowed a lot by Alexander himself, which a lot of people tend to kind of sideline his father. But a lot of the foundation of what Alexander would go on to achieve, so he's known for his conquest against the Persian Empire, that was originally something that was planned by his father, Philip II. A lot of the innovations in the Macedonian army that made Alexander so prolific and so victorious, a lot of those innovations were kind of spearheaded by Philip II. But unfortunately for him, but brilliantly for Alexander, Philip dies. Well, he's assassinated, actually, when Alexander is 20. And it's at that point that Alexander becomes king of Macedon. It's at that point he assumes control over a lot of mainland Greece. And it's at that point he takes on Philip's campaign and decides to continue on with this campaign against the Persian Empire. And that is the start of Alexander the Great, because when he starts, he just can't stop. He starts this campaign against Persia when he's still very young. He's only in his very early 20s. And within 10 years, he has completely defeated the Persian Empire. So he's taken in all of those territories. He's spread into North Africa, into Egypt. And off his own back, he also travels into India, into the Indus Valley. And that's the furthest that Greek people had ever traveled before this. They didn't really have much information about that aspect and that area of the world aside from mythological precedents. So people like Dionysus was said to come from the Far East, but Greek people hadn't really traveled that far. So a lot of that is why he is the great, because he covers this vast area. He's so supremely powerful and prolific in terms of his military career. Famously, Alexander the Great was never defeated in battle. So he has this massive trajectory of going from being a young man, you know, but nobody really expected much of him, I don't think, as a young man coming into the fray. I think there was some revolts in Greece when he first started his reign, because they thought, oh, thank God, you know, Philip II's gone now. Let's get the Macedonians off our backs. And it doesn't work, because he kind of exceeds all expectations. And he's at the height of his career, arguably at the age of 32, and he dies very suddenly of a sudden illness. And it's kind of all gone flash with a bang. And he leaves behind this absolutely amazing legacy that when you read the historical accounts, it reads like something from myth, because you think, oh my gosh, this guy, he's doing all these amazing things, going to all these amazing places, meeting all these strange people. There's no way this could have really happened. And some of it is a bit embellished. So there's a big historical tradition around Alexander where a lot of authors wanted to write about him because he was such a great subject. That was a really good way for them to kind of amplify their own work. So because of that, a lot of the more outlandish tales from his reign probably are a little bit embellished. But the crux of the matter is correct, that he kind of forged these achievements that were really unprecedented for the time. But it all happens quite quickly. I think he dies in Babylon in 323. He's just shy of 33 years old. And he doesn't really leave a successful legacy in terms of his lineage. He has an unborn son at that time, but it really leads to this fragmentation of the Greek world, because the empire and the Greek people are now spread across a larger area than before. It can't really sustain itself. So this ushers in a whole new era, the Hellenistic era, where we see the rise of kingdoms once again. The time of the city-state is kind of over by this point, and we're now once again ruled by kings in these various chopped up parts of what was Alexander's empire.
That is so interesting. I feel like I needed that complete rundown of him, because the movie really portrays so much of that, which is kind of impressive of it. It really kind of shows everything, and that's sort of my whole basis for knowledge of Alexander right now, embarrassingly enough. I also am obsessively playing Assassin's Creed Odyssey, which is all during the Peloponnesian War. And all I can think about is the minute you walk into Macedonia, the character just looks around and says, this will be a great empire one day.
I think a funny thing is my friend has been playing it, and I was like, please let me ride around the map to find Macedon. And he was like, Meg, I don't have to go there yet. The quest doesn't start yet. And I was like, please. So I rode around the map for about 20 real life minutes trying to find Macedon.
It's so hard to get to Macedon. It's so hard. And then it's like, there are really high levels, so you really can't go there until you're really high up. But then also, it's just like this huge swath of land all the way at the top. It was annoying to get to, I won't lie. It was quite trying.
It was about 20 real life minutes of me sitting on the back of this horse in the game, just riding. My friend was like, can I have it back now? And I'm like, no, I have
it. No, you have to get there. I mean, it's such a good game for that, for just like obsessing over the visuals of that world. Like, I just want to stare at everything forever. I'm like so excited to talk about what you're saying when it comes to the movie and everything too. So maybe we'll dive into the movie and then we can go into sort of the myth of Alexander from there, since the movie kind of is a myth in itself. So some of the things we were talking about even just before diving into his history, because One of the things that really stood out to me watching the movie was this depiction they had of these cave paintings and Alexander being told the mythologies. So, you know, they were pretty standard Greek myths, you know, Prometheus and Medea, like you mentioned, along with some others. But they went along with these really bizarre cave paintings that didn't remotely resemble anything I've seen when it comes to Greek iconography. And then also given the time period, like we're talking pretty late in the Greek world. So to me, it was all very primitive for something we're not in a primitive time when it comes to Alexander. Like we're post the Peloponnesian War, the Persian War, the height of Athens. Like they are a very sort of high level people at this point.
Yeah, it's definitely a strange choice. I've looked a little bit, but not extensively. I'm not really an archaeologist at heart, but I've looked a bit at the excavations of Pella, because I think in the last sort of 20 years or so, they have excavated the site at Pella and Vergina, which is the kind of heartland of Macedon. They found a lot of very interesting artifacts. There are tombs in Pella and Vergina. There's a famous tomb too, I think is the most famous, where they kind of and ah between whether it belongs to Philip II, like Alexander's actual father, whether it belongs to somebody else. But there's no like caves. I remember watching the scene, you can hear like sort of water dripping faintly. And it's really like they're in a grotto. As far as what I've read, there aren't really any kind of underground caves. And certainly the style that they choose, it almost looks Neolithic in a way. and it doesn't even resemble sort of archaic or geometric stylings. I think probably a much better choice would have been to make it look like vase paintings, because they kind of have that crude, or well, not really crude because they're still beautiful, but I suppose crude compared to what we think of as classical sculpture. They still have that kind of rudimentary, archaic, old look to them, if you can imagine like a 5th century vase with the nice scenes on it. I think that would have been a better choice. But yeah, the cave paintings were quite a fascinating, I don't know whether it's an editorial choice or directorial choice. I'm not really a film studies. I'm not good with film studies vernacular, but it was definitely interesting to me. And from what I've sort of read around the film, I don't think anyone quite has an answer for why. I think we were just trying to think, huh, that's really weird. Why are we got caveman paintings in, you know, mid 4th century Macedon? Because as you say, it's definitely not a rudimentary or kind of rural. Well, it is a rural place, but they certainly are drawing upon the artistic traditions of, you know, Athens at its height. That's, you know, we're 100 years gone. They know those styles by now. So it's a very strange addition, I think.
Yeah, I felt like they kind of went with that in a couple of places when it came to Macedon. And so I wasn't totally sure because I'm not so familiar with Macedon, but I mean, it's not like it's that far. And I mean, we have even Bronze Age imagery to work off of and sculptures and things. That's why I found it so interesting, because you can go so much farther back and see what the Greeks were doing in the general region and have an idea. And it was not like those cave paintings. So what are some other sort of the things that stand out to you in the movie in terms of what you were talking about? You know, what are some other fun Alexander, the person / the movie / whatever that sort of stand out to you?
I think the thing that because when I watched it, I tried to watch it with as fresh eyes as possible, because I think the worst thing you can do when you come into films like this, just as a general rule, is to get too stuck up on historical accuracy, because I don't think that's a very productive conversation to have. You know, as I kind of mentioned earlier, my methodology, I guess, for things like this is I like to think, okay, but why is it written in that way? Why are they making these choices, even if they strike me as being odd? And the thing that I think I took away from Oliver Stone's vision, that is the bit that I can't really reconcile, is that Alexander was so unlikable, but not in a deliberate way. I think that I came away from it wishing I could have seen a different film. I think a far more interesting film would have been, okay, take the most, you know, horrid aspects of Oliver Stone's Alexander, of which there are a lot, and actually like hone in on those points. I think he could have easily made a film where Alexander is almost the hero of his own story, but the villain of everyone else's. I think what I liked about Stone's vision is how you could see from his companions how frustrated they were getting with this never-ending journey. I think the scene that sticks out that makes me kind of laugh but also go, aw, is the one where they're traveling somewhere and they're all bundled up and they've got like frosty eyebrows, and you think, oh my god, these poor Greeks, they're used to sunshine, suntan, oil, and here they are in like the frosty mountains. Oh my god, you monster, Alexander, let them go home. And that's what kind of stuck me. I thought, but that's quite an interesting angle, and I think Stone kind of touched upon it, because you got to see his men arguing with him, and you got to see the poor frozen Macedonians with their frostbitten toes and fingers, but it never gave you enough to justify why that was either okay or why it was completely bad. I think the problem and the attraction, I think, of Alexander, whether that's in film or history or anything, is that he's such a divisive character. You can never decide whether he's good or bad. He's always fluctuating between these two poles of, oh, well, he's good because he had this enlightened vision and he just wanted to unite the world under one like common education, which, I mean, is very questionable, but that's kind of the one side. And you have the other side of, oh, he was just a terrible, you know, dictator, bloodthirsty, you know, glory hunting, terrible person. And he's always kind of fluctuating in between. And I think perhaps what stuck with me about Stone's Alexander is I couldn't quite decide or work out where Stone was trying to pitch him between these different sides. Because on the one hand, he's very romantic with a capital R. He's always got these big ideas and these big grand gestures, which I think plays into part of how Stone uses the idea of Prometheus. But then he's also got this terrible temper, murders people, is having fights with his friends left, right, and center. And I found it interesting how it never kind of settled between those two. So, I mean, I wonder, what did you think of Alexander's character in this film? Like, how did he come across to you? Was he like a hero of his own story or the villain of everyone else's?
I think it's similar to what you were just saying, is it almost seems like you're not supposed to know, or nobody in doing the movie decided, because he really is sort of everything all at once. And I think what this movie did too much of was try to be everything. It tried to retell every moment of Alexander's story, and then as a result sort of came across as just like too much of everything. And so I think that's sort of true of his character too, where I think at the beginning you kind of try to feel for him. You sort of see the relationship with his mother, which we also definitely want to talk about. And so to anyone who hasn't watched this movie too, his mother, Alexander is played by Colin Farrell in an interesting role. And then his mother is Angelina Jolie in a very Angelina Jolie type role. But I think you kind of feel for him at the beginning there, but then he sort of just spirals and becomes sort of just over the top. But it's very difficult to determine how you're supposed to feel about him, because he is just so much.
Yeah, he's just everything. But I think that you can have a story of a character where they start off, you know, perhaps young and naive. I think that the early Alexander in Oliver Stone's film is supposed to be young and naive. You can certainly start off at that point and have you believe and root for them, but then it turns out they spiral out of control, and by the end of it, you just feel kind of pity or disappointed or disgust. I think you can have a story that tells that tale, but I don't think Stone's story quite managed it, because even at the end, we're kind of, he's still having his long rambling speeches to, you know, poor Hephaestion vis-a-vis Jared Leto, who is just, I think, he just feels, his character is so, it's not even a character. When I was rewatching it, I just thought, my God, he's just there to have bit like big blue eyes and just for Alexander to bounce his monologues off. That's all he does. He practically speaks in third person. He never speaks to him on a human level, which is, I think, another one of the drawbacks of the film, is that there is no character of Hephaestion. He literally is just there for Alexander to bounce these ideas off. But I think that by the end, we still haven't got like this definitive, oh, he's lost his marbles, he's kind of spiraled, because he still is clutching onto this dream. So I think that, I think something would have had to have been cut away, because there is so much to the Alexander story. That's part and parcel of what it is to study Alexander, is there's always going to be conflicting reports because there's just so much written about him. But I think you have to make a decision to cut something. You have to choose what you're going to do with him. And I think, as you said, they just put everything in, which is why it's A, 3.5 hours long, and B, no one ever wants to talk about it, because it doesn't make for as cohesive a film experience as I think a lot of people wanted from it.
You could have definitely had a couple fewer battles and just made the point that yes, he won a lot of battles. We didn't have to see them all. But I think that's really true about Hephaestion, and he is so important. But you're right. It's sort of Jared Leto's just kind of there to be there, looking very, it's one of his more Jared Leto-esque roles.
When I researched this film before, one of the things I looked at was like gender and sort of masculinity. And the costuming is so intricate and detailed, because if you watch it, you can see like Hephaestion's face is gradually getting more and more beaten up as time goes on. You can kind of see he has like these little additional scars put in, and you're like, oh, so they're paying attention to the fact that these guys are battling and taking on damage and stuff, but he just never really is fleshed out as a human being. It's like, oh, they had so much detail, but kind of in the wrong places.
Yeah, that's really true.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
So let's talk about Hephaestion in general and Alexander, because, of course, in the movie, and I think also in reality, they were sort of in a relationship, but couldn't officially be in a relationship because of, you know, various patriarchal norms and the like. And Alexander needed an heir and he needed a wife and et cetera, et cetera. But Hephaestion is interesting in the movie because it's supposed to show that they were very much in love and Alexander was devoted to him, but also, like you say, Hephaestion doesn't have so much of a character as he is just kind of like a sounding board throughout.
Yeah, and I think it's a shame that that's the direction they went, because I think you could do a lot potentially with this relationship, because there's a lot of space to do a lot of things, because this is the guy who, you know, historically was, they grew up together, you know, whether they continue being lovers into adulthood is something you can't always ascertain. But I think it's a bit erroneous at this point to say, well, you know, maybe they were just friends, because that's kind of like, well, it's not really the point. They were definitely doing something. And even if not, like, they were at least the closest people to each other within this camp for the longest of times. And I think that's a really interesting relationship. You could have done a lot in there. They could have had frank conversations. He could have been the only person to say, look, Alexander, you're killing everyone out there. This is a bad thing, if that was the angle they wanted to go. Which maybe Hephaestion didn't say, because, you know, historically Hephaestion was a bit of a yes man, and that was his role. He was there to be, you know, Alexander's second in command, his closest companion. He was there to be, I think they were brother-in-law at some point, because during the mass marriages, Alexander took on three wives in his lifetime. But he marries two other Persian women, one of which his sister marries Hephaestion. So at some point they become, you know, family, which I think they do touch upon in the film, because as he's dying, he says something about their children playing together, growing up together, something like that. But it was a very interesting dynamic that they could have explored more with. But I think the dynamic that they really hammered home was this Achilles, Patroclus, Alexander, Hephaestion paradigm. That was something that I think was quite important to the film, which they say very explicitly. You know, I think one of their many romantic balcony chats, they're always having talks on this balcony. And all the scenes kind of merge together in my head. I think they must do it at least three separate times, but I just can't separate them because it's all the same kind of thing. Hephaestion stands there, looks very doe-eyed. Alexander goes on a grand monologue. But, you know, at some point he does say, you know, like, oh, if you're Achilles, then that means I'm Patroclus, and that means I'm going to die. And Alexander's like, I wouldn't let that happen because I love you. And it's all very like, oh, okay, we're doing this. So they really do make a point of making it explicit that they are, you know, they are going for this Achilles, Patroclus paradigm, which is not, I mean, that's a very accepted thing, I think, in a lot of scholarship, in a lot of secondary literature, that the two of them associated their relationship with Achilles and Patroclus in historical events. surrounding. We know that Alexander journeyed to the ancient site of Troy while he was on this campaign, and that he and Patroclus made sacrifices in honor of Achilles. Sorry, he and Hephaestion, my goodness, made sacrifices, and they, you know, ran a naked foot race and stuff and things like that. And we know that when Hephaestion died, Alexander put on this great display of mourning. He was like sobbing for like 3 days and like cut off all of his hair, and had like commissioned this massive funeral pyre that would have cost, I remember reading the sort of approximate evaluation, and it was like in the billions that it would have been. He was going to like blow the whole treasury on this in a way that a lot of later authors who were writing this all up directly identified with Achilles's, you know, over exaggerated mourning of Patroclus. So we can kind of guess that within their own lifetimes they were consciously making this decision to associate themselves with Achilles and Patroclus, and whether that was just kind of a private romantic thing or whether it served like a greater propagandic purpose, it's, you know, maybe six of one, half a dozen of the other. So that's one of the things that Stone puts into this film throughout, that you can kind of see, oh no, I'm 100% on board with that. I get why they're doing this. This makes complete sense. And it's a very deliberate invocation of the myth that is very consistent with sort of what I think most people who know about Alexander know, that, oh, well, Alexander wanted to be like Achilles. He also loved Hephaestion, and they were like, you know, best buddies. It makes sense, but it's an interesting one how it's invoked sort of in childhood. I find this scene where they're training with Aristotle. Yeah, they're training, they're talking with Aristotle, and they're talking about kind of very grandiose ideas for whatever they're supposed to be, like 11, 12 year old boys, about conquering and about heroes and things like that. And they bring up the Achilles and Patroclus, and he was saying, oh, you know, oh, well, didn't he do all those things because he was motivated by his love for Patroclus? So it's a point that's kind of brought up in childhood and then revisited in adulthood. So it's kind of one of the more consistent, I think, parts of the film and its use of Greek myth.
I think that's it's fascinating in contradiction to the fact that Troy came out in the same year, too, because the idea that they both came out in the same year, and Alexander was so obsessed with that idea of Achilles and Patroclus, which, like you say, is pretty accurate. And then that Troy came out at the same time and was like, they're cousins, Achilles loves women, is a very interesting to have the two movies out at the same time and have these two very different ideas of Achilles and Patroclus.
Yeah, I need to, something that I want to do, but I haven't had the time and or kind of mental sturdiness to do, is I really am curious to watch the original theatrical release of Alexander and then watch the longest version, because I know that when the original release came out in theatres, they had quite a bit of backlash from Greek people because they didn't like the fact that there was this very romantic, you know, situation going on between Alexander and Hephaestion. There was, if you kind of Google search it, you'll get up like sort of the old news articles about Greek lawyers threatening to sue Warner Brothers or whoever it was who distributed the film because of this. And you think, you know, 2004 was a very different time back then in terms of, you know, people's attitudes towards this. And then the re-release, which came out, I think it's 2012. I'm going to stick with that because I know it's in that area. That put back in a lot of the material that was taken out, and a lot of the material that was taken out was to do with some of the more homoerotic elements. So because Alexander has a relationship with Hephaestion, but he also has this relationship with the Persian eunuch as well, and they have a full-on sex scene in the long version, in the 3.5-hour version, and that was completely cut out of the original release. So I would definitely be interested to go back and see how much of the Alexander and Hephaestion content is watered down in the original, because I know there was some of it that was kind of taken out, but it must have still been there in some capacity for people to be angry about it. But it is interesting that they went in those two very different directions, is that Troy was like, you know what, we're not doing this, we're going to completely ignore this aspect and just elide it totally, whereas Alexander was like, no, this is going to be a fairly key component of Alexander's interpersonal relationships. I think the main relationships really are with his mother, which we're going to have to come to because it's absolutely fascinating and or horrifying. And it really is Hephaestion. They have the most conversations with each other. So I think it would be an interesting exercise to kind of, but that would involve watching it for like 6 hours straight. And I don't think I can handle Colin Farrell's for that long.
Oh, no, I wouldn't. I think I remember it being pretty subtle, though, in the original one, where it definitely wasn't explicit because, like you say, like 2004 was a very different time. I remember, I don't know, I'm trying to think back because I definitely saw it in the theater, but I'm remembering it sort of more of a, yeah, I think it was more implied, but it was a lot less explicit.
Yeah, whereas the longer version is kind of like, no, they're absolutely... I don't think they kiss. I know he kisses the eunuch in the long version. I don't think him and Faishin kiss, but they definitely do a lot of wistful gazes. And what I found so interesting, which is such a Christianizing aspect of it, is that Faishin comes to Alexander on his marriage night and gives him a ring. I found that so interesting. I was like, wow, it's a very Christianizing element, because of course rings in antiquity didn't mean marriage, and obviously not between two men. The idea of marriage between two men is completely absurd when you put it in the ancient Greek context. It would never exist. But I think definitely if you're putting it towards a modern, you know, Western English speaking audience predominantly, so to have the, you know, I guess you would call them love interests, or at least intimate companion, come to you on your wedding night to somebody else, but still a wedding night, and give you a ring, I thought was a very interesting choice.
It definitely was. And it's presented, it's just a very awkward scene in general, I would say. Like, it's, yeah, you can see the intention with what they're doing there, but it was an odd one. I wasn't expecting that, for sure.
It's a very interesting symbol, the ring, because he kind of keeps it with him for the whole film. And as he's dying, he's kind of holding up the ring to... There's kind of that weird scene with the CGI eagle that is kind of almost as if it's Zeus coming to collect him for the afterlife, because he's, you know, sweating, he's fevered, he's dying. And the ring smashes. And it's kind of... This ring almost symbolizes a lot of his hopes and his ideas for empire that are destroyed, that smash upon his deathbed. But then interestingly, I think this is definitely in the long cut and not in the short cut, when they come back to Ptolemy at the end, because obviously the narrator of the film is old Ptolemy, we find out. When you look at him, he's wearing the ring just with the gemstone smashed. And I think it made almost an interesting comment. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but what I took away from it was that ring really kind of symbolized Alexander's hopes for his empire, because that's all him and Hephaestion seem to talk about, is how much he wants to build this empire with him. It's almost going to be their legacy. And obviously the gem is missing, the heart of it's missing, but, you know, the fragments of the empire remains, and Ptolemy was arguably the most successful of all of the successor generals. So I found it very interesting that is almost continued, and it's been picked up by him. I was like, wow, there's a lot that I could write a whole essay on this one piece of jewelry alone.
No, that's very true. I feel like that must sort of be the purpose there. Especially because, like you say, I mean, the Ptolemies were definitely the most, I mean, they're the successor general that I know of, certainly, and then the generations and generations of them that ruled Egypt in that way. So Angelina Jolie, let's talk Alexander's mother and Angelina Jolie, because it's quite the opinion of his mother they're putting forth in this movie. So I'm so curious what your thoughts are on her in the movie, but also her historically.
I think her depiction in the movie is awful. Just because it's such a...
I hoped so.
It is just awful. I think the accent is terrible, and I feel bad because I genuinely like Angelina Jolie as an actress. I think she's quite a talented actress. I thought she was English for the longest of times because of her voice in Tomb Raider. I think it's such a convincing English accent. So I've got nothing wrong. There's nothing about Angelina Jolie that I particularly dislike, but she is very bad in this film. And I don't know if that's because the direction that she was given. I can't comment on that. But I mean, on the one hand, it is kind of true to what I guess the historical Olympias as she is recorded, because a lot of the information that we have about Olympias, her most kind of divisive portrayal comes from Plutarch, who was a Greek writer, and he did a lot of character pieces for a lot of figures from antiquity. He wrote about Alexander, he wrote about Julius Caesar. Most notable Greeks and Romans will have a biography written by Plutarch, and his whole thing is that he's a biographer, not a historian. He's kind of there to capture their character more than he is to write down what literally happened. So a lot of his pieces are very good, they're very interesting to read, but you need to take them with like a whole like mammoth heap of salt. But he writes Olympia as being this kind of almost like a caricature of like a dangerous woman. You know, she's into the cult of Dionysus. She slept with snakes. You know, maybe Zeus is the father of Alexander because she slept with snakes, and maybe the animal went, you know, impregnated her, and that's why Alexander was, you know, so godlike in his abilities. And, you know, she's this kind of ruthless woman, and she's a mysterious woman. So that is kind of true of, I guess, a lot of what the ancient authors were writing about her. But then again, that's standard for a lot of ancient authors writing about women. I thought it was interesting that they brought up Medea in the cave scene. I think the cave scene we're going to have to come back to, because it introduces five key myths. They mention Achilles, they mention Heracles, they mention Medea, they mention Oedipus, and they mention Prometheus. So I think the bringing up Medea was kind of interesting, because I think that's the character that she was almost going for. I think part of the film that struck me as being the most strange was Olympias and her relationship with Alexander's father, because we know they don't get along. I think, I can't remember the chronology because it's so butchered, but, you know, early on when you see them, you know, Philip's about to assault her in a drunken rage, and that Alexander kind of is there and is a bystander and stops him by being there. And also her snakes are there, and that stops him as well. So it's a very strange, quite disturbing scene. I think it's kind of implied throughout, because if you're watching it not knowing what happened, I can't remember when Philip's assassination, sorry, spoiler alert, comes into it, because again, the chronology is more in chronological order, but it's kind of throughout the film, there's almost this, did she, didn't she, did Alexander, didn't he? There's this, did she, didn't she, did Olympias murder Philip? Because what we get from it is that she hates him. You know, her son's going to avenge her. She like screams something to that effect at him. She's like, you know, my son's going to come and get you if you, you know, keep being horrible to me. But there's also, it's a bit more complicated than that, because she doesn't just hate him. There's also this element of sexual jealousy, which is so anachronistic, because Philip married, I think it's something like 6 or 7 times. I can't quite remember. He had multiple wives. It was sort of polygamy and diplomacy in a sense. So he married Olympias because she was from Epirus and they wanted to have some kind of alliance, some kind of connection there. And I think Olympias was not even his first wife, if I recall correctly. So this idea, I think, I can't remember verbatim the exchange, but it's something about Alexander being like, oh, you hated my father. You know, you're glad he's dead. She's like, oh, I didn't hate him. I loved him. And you're like, what? What? Because she spent the whole film saying, you know, he's horrible, I hate him. She wears like scarlet red and she glowers at him as he's being murdered. And that's such a visual clue. You're like, I bet she killed him. And there's bits where, you know, Alexander quarrels with Philip, which historically did happen. Alexander and Philip had a little bit of a tempestuous relationship. There's an incident where they did quarrel upon Philip's marriage to another younger woman, where he thought he was being insulted. So they had a fight and he had to flee Macedon for a while. But then he came back and they were seemingly all best friends by the time he was assassinated. So there is kind of that historical precedent for them not having this great relationship. But the idea that Olympias would exert this kind of sexual jealousy because Philip's marrying a younger woman, or this idea that she was, you know, in love with him, and it's kind of all her anger's motivated by a kind of spurned romance, is very much something that is like for the modern audience, because this idea of sexual jealousy is just not compatible with the polygamous marriages that would have happened in the Macedonian court. It wasn't unusual for Macedonian kings to have more than one wife. So it's very, very odd. But I mean, Angelina Jolie plays it very well. It's a bit two note and it's very two dimensional, but she does kind of the one dimensional scheming, sexually jealous woman brilliantly. But it is, I mean, her costuming is fantastic. I remember reading somewhere that they wanted to do a more historically accurate costume with like sort of a veil type thing, not like a full face veil, but kind of like an over the head, more like a ketone type thing. And Angelina Jolie went, nope. I want to look fab. So that's got kind of like the blood red, one-shouldered, gold, everything. She looks amazing, but it's all very odd.
That's interesting to know, yeah, that polygamy was so widespread there, because it certainly suggests that their take on her as a character is based in a more modern misogyny then, because she really is. Like, she's really depicted as quite an evil woman, and very much those sort of typical stereotypes of a jealous woman in sort of an over the top and gross kind of way. So the idea that that's all very much modern is not surprising, but I would say disappointing. But she definitely does do it well. And the snakes, the way they incorporate the snakes is disturbing and very well done. I'm not a snake person, so I think I'll inherently find it disturbing, but it's very well done.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. And I hope we come to Alexander's marriage to Roxanne, because it's all part of this Oedipal theme that Stone really, I don't know if he introduces it, because obviously there is sort of evidence of Alexander's strange relationship with his parents, but I've never seen it to be so strong in anything that I've read before as it is in this film. This kind of Oedipal overtone of Alexander's strange relationship with his mother. And again, something I've read that has never been confirmed, but it was a rumor, is that Angelina Jolie and Colin Farrell were like together at the time. They were like secretly dating, or at least hitting it off and, you know, sneaking off on set while filming Alexander. So that might that might explain some of the weird chemistry. I don't know, but it's definitely odd. But when you meet Roxanne, who he marries, who's played by Rosario Dawson, and again a very one-dimensional, just sort of barbarian woman character, they sort of, at one point there's like a zoom in on her arm and she's wearing like a snake bracelet, and I think everyone's kind of alarm bells went off, like, oh my god, snakes, just like his mother. Everyone's like sort of screaming, like, ah. So they kind of really are supposed to be each other's equal in a sense. He's almost married his mother, not literally like Oedipus, but he's married what is essentially his mother, because it's the same one-dimensional character. It's the same, you know, sexually jealous barbarian princess type, because Roxanne is for some reason sexually jealous of Hephaestion, which is absolutely bizarre, which is absolutely for the modern audience. There's no you know, there's no way that would have been something of any concern, I think, in antiquity, because there's no way that Hephaestion could have occupied any kind of position, because he could never be Alexander's wife. He could never be the parent to Alexander's heirs. So that's a very interesting and odd angle, is Roxanne's sexual jealousy over Hephaestion. And after his death, Hephaestion's death, I think Alexander goes and he accuses her of murdering him. And it's a very weird scene, because that's definitely something that is sort of mostly for the modern audience, because there's no reason why the historical Roxanne would have had any sexual jealousy over Hephaestion at all. So it kind of almost is a parallel to his mother and his father and her sexual jealousy. So it's a very odd take that must be invented for the modern audience. But I don't know if it adds anything. I don't really think if it makes the film more enjoyable. If anything, it just makes it a bit weird.
It makes it more obviously anti-woman too. Like, those are the only two women in the movie, and they are both meant to be really unlikable characters.
Yeah, she's just, I mean, yeah, Olympias is, and the thing that I like about it, well, not like, but that kind of made me giggle darkly, is I think when Philip is assassinated, there's kind of blood, everyone's screaming, crying, and obviously he's just married the young Eurydice, and they have a little baby, is Angelina Jolie's Olympias gives her this really nasty side eye. And in the history, Olympias had his new wife and baby murdered, supposedly. So it's kind of like, if you know what's coming.
Yeah, that's a fun additional detail. So all the Oedipal talk there, I think we should dive into the other myths that are brought up in the weird cave painting scene. So like you said, they definitely wanted to include these Oedipal overtones when it came to his mother and his wife, which was an interesting decision. But then, I mean, the Medea, I find interesting. What do you think the intention was in referencing Medea?
I think a lot of it is just to give this dark character to Olympias, because Philip goes on this very much misogynist anti-woman rant where he's like, you can't try, I can't do an Irish accent. I think it'd be really funny if I could, but it really is, you know, giving it to Alexander, saying, you know, you can't trust women. We spend all of our lives, you know, running away from our mothers. And, you know, women make slaves of us, is the quotes that like come to mind. And Alexander's just like, my mom wouldn't hurt me, because Philip's telling him about Medea, who murdered her, you know, famously murdered her children to get back at Jason, is often the way that's interpreted. So, you know, Philip's telling him, and Alexander's a bit like, my mother wouldn't hurt me. So it's a very interesting thing to bring up, but I just think it's part of this wider, I guess, the film is very misogynist, because it is just, there are practically no women in it. The women that are in it are, you know, one-dimensional caricatures of, you know, barbarian, sexy princess lady, but she's also very sexually jealous and aggressive. So it was an interesting one to bring up because, again, Medea and Alexandra, I don't think you would see together in many other contexts. So it's certainly an interesting parallel because, I mean, in the myth of Medea, I think I'm most familiar with Euripides' Medea, but she is also a barbarian woman made wife because she's not from, you know, mainland Greece. She's from the furthest reaches. She's from Colchis, which is the end of the world. So when she's brought into Jason's life, you know, falls in love with him, marries him. But I suppose it's a civil marriage, I guess you would call it, because then Jason's like, actually, I want a proper marriage now to a proper nice people. You could almost say that that is what we're trying to get at with Olympias, that she's from Epirus. She's not actually from Macedon. So when Philip marries a young girl from Macedon, you know, their children are going to be pure Macedonian. They're going to be of a higher standing. So I guess it's trying to make that Olympias and Medea parallel. But again, I mean, Olympias had no reason to kill her children to get back at her husband, but it's certainly an interesting thing. This idea of the barbarian woman in the Alexander film is, I think, something that could be explored a bit more. I wish it could be, but it's difficult because where do you go with it? Because they are so two-dimensional, well, one-dimensional. They don't really do anything. But it's an interesting myth to bring in, and it almost makes me think maybe Oliver Stone is aware of this stereotype. Maybe that's why he's doing it, but does it excuse it? Probably not.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to make the connection with his mother to both Medea and Jocasta is like, you really don't think very highly of these women in the movie, do you? Like, to make those two connections that are not explicit in the story and are definitely made for the movie, and then to have that just be, well, that's the women. That's all of them.
I mean, you know, Alexander history is, there's not a huge amount of women to talk about on his campaign. It is just kind of him and his boys, and then him and his boys and their wives and their lovers. There's not really a lot you can say, I suppose, about the women in Alexander's life. But, you know, Olympias outside of, you know, after Alexander's death, Olympias took in Roxanne and his then son was born, Alexander IV. And they did fight. I'm not so well versed on the Wars of the Successors, but Olympias did have a contingent of people to try and defend Macedon from people who were trying to become the new regent. So she had a little bit of a military career herself. And that's definitely one of the projects that I want to look at in the future, is looking a bit more into the historic Olympias, because she seems to have done some quite powerful things. But again, in the Greek mind, that's a bad, dangerous woman, because she does powerful things. She acts like a man. So it's definitely hard to, I guess, separate what is just pure ancient Greek misogyny and what is modern misogyny inserted into the film. But I think that this sexual jealousy angle, the Oedipal element, is something that is modern misogyny inserted into the film, because that's certainly not something that is apparent in the ancient sources, is this kind of Oedipal Medea aspect, because there's no reason why she would necessarily have to fear being a barbarian woman. That is what the conflict was with Alexander and his father when they had a fight just after his father's most recent marriage. He took on himself the conversation that was happening, and he felt that he was being insulted because there was a wish that his father's new marriage would produce legitimate children, and he took that as an insult. But you know, some of the scholarship that I've read reviewing this incident has said, well, that's not really it sounds odd now, but that's not an unusual toast at a wedding. You know, may you have nice, legitimate children with your new wife. Doesn't necessarily mean that your previous children with your other lovely wives are illegitimate. Just that's what we're toasting to now. But Alexander, being the very sensitive soul that he is, took it personally and threw a cup at someone's head, and it started a fight. So
Alexander, yeah, he's quite a character, it sounds like, just historically and in the movie. So what about some of the myths that are referenced in that cave scene? We have Prometheus and Heracles, and of course we've talked all about Achilles.
The Heracles one is definitely an interesting one. I think it's probably the one that has the most historical basis. So Heracles is a figure. He's one of the great Greek heroes. He's probably one of the most widely celebrated Greek heroes because he has relevance to a lot of areas of Greece, because Greece is divided up into so many different sections. They all kind of have deities and heroes that have different significance, but Heracles is very widely appreciated. But he's particularly appreciated in Macedon because the Macedonian kings draw their lineage from Heracles. When you go way, way back, that's kind of the yarn that they spin, is that, you know, we're descended from Heracles, especially the Argead dynasty, which is Alexander, his father, and his forebearers. So Heracles crops up a fair few times in terms of sort of ancient Macedon, in terms of their sort of royal image. So there's numismatic evidence, so coinage that was produced by Philip II and his predecessors would have sometimes utilized the portrait of Heracles. So normally his very iconic lion skin cap, that's how you normally be like, ah, yeah, that's Heracles, or his club. And by putting on their coins, they're kind of just saying, you know, we're the kings, we're descended from Heracles, he's a Greek hero, he's really cool. That means that we are also really strong and cool. And it's just this typical, you know, making allusions to historical or mythological figures to kind of add more importance to yourself in the present, because everybody recognizes these cultural signifiers. If you see a coin and you see, oh, this is for Philip II of Macedon, oh, it's got Heracles on it, I bet he's a guy you don't want to mess with. It's probably a bit of a sort of reduction of it, but that's essentially what it is. I think propaganda is a bit of an anachronistic term, but it's sort of along those lines. It's sort of a constructed royal image. So Heracles features a lot in that. So we have that background for Alexander being born and becoming king in his own right. But Heracles is important as a figure of massive achievement. You know, the 12 labors out of all the heroes, Heracles probably does the most. So that kind of seems to form this figure for emulation for Alexander. He wants to emulate the greatness of Heracles by doing lots of things, by achieving lots of things. And there's definitely moments in his campaign where he seems to be going places and pushing the envelope too far just because he wants to outdo these mythological predecessors. So an example that I think of is when he was on campaign near India and sieging and this place at Aornos. And the Aornos rock was supposedly very, very difficult to siege. Supposedly Heracles had tried in his lifetime and he had failed to do so. So when writing this incident in their histories, writers like Arrian, writers like Plutarch, make a point to deliberately say, you know, Alexander was really keen on this siege because he wanted to outdo Heracles. Heracles was his immediate predecessor. He was his ancestor through blood, literally, but he's also his ancestor in terms of greatness. He wants to surpass him to be the best. He's got, you know, he's very much a type A personality. So the myth of Heracles is invoked several times in the literature surrounding Alexander and also several times in his image. Supposedly towards the end of his life, when Alexander was getting a little bit big for his boots, there's some suggestions from fragments of history that he would dress up as Heracles for hunting trips and he would wear an imitation lion skin cap. There's a very beautiful image on the so-called Alexander sarcophagus, which I've researched and written about. I think it's absolutely amazing. And one of the figures on this sarcophagus, it's not Alexander himself who's in the sarcophagus, it belongs to somebody else, a client king in Sidon who knew Alexander. But the reason why it's called the so-called Alexander sarcophagus is because on one of the panels, which is a beautiful fight scene, you have a figure that everybody says, my gosh, this must be Alexander, because the figure is wearing a Heracles' lion skin cap. And it's just amazing that he would be so brazenly wearing these attributes of heroes, and that attribute of a hero is now used to identify Alexander because he's associating himself so closely with it. But Stone doesn't seem to do much with Heracles in the film. He doesn't really seem to appear. We never really see Alexander dressed up as Heracles. Not that I can recall anyway. I think that would have been quite a fun little bit for the costume department. But he's brought up as an example of suffering.
And the Prometheus of him, I would interpret that to sort of be that obsession of, you know, bringing the Macedonian Greek world to everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think now we call a spade a spade. It, you know, it's colonization, it's imperial. It might lack kind of the racial overtones of kind of later empires when we think of, because race and antiquity is a very different ballpark. But it is colonialism, it is imperialism. But there is this idea that was sort of perpetuated around Alexander history, particularly of the late 19th, early 20th century, I think it's dubbed the Brotherhood of Mankind theory, which is a scholar called W.W. Tarn, who was really the biggest proponent of this. This very romantic notion that Alexander only did these conquests and only went on these battles and killed all these people because he wanted to unite mankind under an enlightened philosophy, under, you know, Greek education, Greek art. All of this was seen as being enlightened and better, and that he only really had good intentions. He just wanted to unite everybody. And that, you know, a theory which now kind of look at and go, I don't think so. I tend to think of it as, you know, the dissemination of culture is more of a natural byproduct of invasion than it is a motivator. I think kind of retroactively you look at it and think, oh, you know, maybe he went there to spread Greek culture, but it's far more likely that Greek culture spread because he went there. So you just kind of flip it the other way around.
Well, also, I think that's an argument that could be used to defend almost all instances of like the worst colonialization and imperialism that we've had in history. Is like, I mean, you could say the same thing for North America. Well, they just wanted to spread Christianity. They had good intentions. And it's like, well, that doesn't count. You don't get to use that as an excuse for what you've done, kind of thing. So yeah, it's an interesting argument there. But I think that just even using Prometheus in general for that is fascinating, of likening yourself to the god who gave humans sort of everything they needed to survive. It's very, I mean, it's all about that ego. Is that something that Alexander used historically, Prometheus, or is that more of a just in the movie?
I've certainly never come across anything of Alexander likening himself to Prometheus. Alexander did make use of historical precedents and mythological motivators. You know, he acknowledges Achilles, he acknowledges Heracles, he acknowledges Dionysus as well. And other people attribute those three to him, but those are really the main three. Figures like Oedipus that are never brought together with Alexander, but Stone has done that for the purposes of the film. And definitely figures like Prometheus are never really brought together with Alexander. I think it's because Prometheus in our modern understanding has almost become synonymous with somebody who's innovative. If you're innovative and you want to do something outside the box, you're kind of considered to be a Prometheus. So I think that's the meaning that it's taken on for us, that maybe Stone has in mind when he's making these comparisons. Because I think Stone's Alexander, his fire that he wants to give people is not very well fleshed out, but he kind of is freedom, which is a very, you know, Americanized way. But, you know, there's conversations having where he says, you know, I've come to free people, I've come to free slaves, which is absolutely bizarre because Alexander had no interest in freeing slaves. Why would he do that? Greece was a slave-based society. Persia was a slave-based society. Persians weren't barbarians in the Greek imagination because they kept slaves, because the Greeks did that too.
Yeah.
So there's this line of, I can't remember where it is, but it's one of his monologues, or not monologue, one of his conversations with Hephaestion, where he's just bouncing off these grand ideas, and they mention something about freeing slaves. That's what they want to do. They want to, you know, and he says something. He's very much a Prometheus, I think, in the fact that he feels like he's not appreciated. Mm. He's very much an underappreciated genius, because he says, you know, these people don't see it, but I want them to be free. I want them to read. I want them to write. And that's such I think that is where like the American aspect comes through. This idea that freedom, literacy, these are all this is the fire that, you know, Promethean Alexander is going to give people. When in reality, he was never going to free populations. Nobody would do that. Of course, he's going to have lots and lots of slaves because he's living in ancient Greece. They had a slave-based society. That was their economic powerhouse. He's got no interest in doing that. And, you know, reading and writing and freeing the populations, he's got no interest in any of that. That's very much where the American aspect of this comes from. And I think that's what the Promethean thing is. It's kind of the American dream of freedom and literacy and that kind of thing. So that's very much a modern insert, I think, for the purposes of the film. But I think it is interesting that they've hung that hat on Prometheus, because it's a very interesting myth to invoke here for these purposes. But I think it does it fairly well in that it makes sense. Like, oh well, he considers himself a Prometheus because he's bringing something to people who are lesser than he is. He considers himself kind of above them all, and yet it's not appreciated. You know, mm-hmm. people are not saying, you know, fire. He's going to be punished for it, basically. And I guess his punishment, in a sense, is he never gets to see these things through. He has his early death. And if, you know, the twist at the end of the film, which took me by surprise, the first time I saw it was old Ptolemy recounting at the end, goes, yeah, we killed him. And I was like, oh my gosh. So the idea that at the very end, old Ptolemy and the successors, he's like, yeah, we killed him because he was going too far. And dreamers are terrible because dreamers kill everyone around them. And then they kill themselves because, you know, you can't be a dreamer. That was kind of that's his pecking the liver out moment. That's his punishment. And at the end, when you see something coming down to him, it is an eagle. The eagle is coming for him. And people interpreted that as meaning it's Zeus.
Right.
Or is it the eagle coming to peck out his liver, i.e. he's going to die because he's pushed things too far and people have turned on him?
Yeah, that's very true. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's interesting.
I think an interesting point to maybe finish on, and just to kind of put it back to what we've been at the very beginning with the context of when it came out, sort of, in with all these other films, is another film that has received a lot of criticism for its Orientalism, for its racism against people in the Middle East, is 300, because of the absurd, you know, caricature of what the Persians are like. They're kind of uber effeminate, just like degenerate, you know, dangerous other. And that really is kind of coming into a lot of this, I guess, anxiety and fear that around sort of people from the Middle East that was going around in the mid-noughties, you know, and the terrible racism that people from the Middle East suffered as a result. And when you look at Alexander and its treatment of the Persians, it's not nice at all. You know, the first, you know, when, as soon as it comes into Babylon, I think you have them going into the harem and all the kind of giggling exotic women that look like they're, you know, parodies out of a pantomime. And, you know, the way that the king, Darius III, is not given any speaking lines, he's just kind of there and then he runs away. And the reaction of his Macedonian men as well, because one of the sort of great talking points of Alexander's career and his reign is his adoption of some Persian culture and customs. You know, he invaded Persia, but there were points in his campaigns where he was taking on Persian dress, he was training up Persian soldiers, he married Persian women. And that was a point of criticism historically, but in the film it takes on a whole nother element where the scene with Clitus, the, you know, his friend who is the most vocal critic of him and who he eventually, you know, stabs and murders in this drunken rage. You know, at some point he's yelling at Alexander that he's not going to wear Persian clothes. He'd rather die than wear, you know, these things. And it's interesting that as Alexander goes through this period of, he does degenerate as the film goes on. You know, he loses his friends. He becomes more paranoid. He has more emotional breakdowns. He becomes more and more visually other, more and more visually Persian. If you notice, his hair gets longer. He wears robes. You know, he's sitting there at one point in this golden robe, just chest out, just lounging. He's, you know, he wears more eyeliner. So as time goes on, he's getting more and more Persianized according to, as, you know, the film is depicting Persians. And a scene that really sticks in my mind that I sort of think encapsulates a lot of the problems of Oliver Stone's film, it's in the longer version, it's in the 3.5-hour version, because the eunuch Bagoas was completely cut out of the original theatrical release, if I remember rightly. He sort of appears flash and you'll miss it once. But in the longer version, he has a much more prominent role because he's this other homoerotic relationship that Alexander has. You have the Greek Hephaestion and then you have the Persian eunuch Bagoas. And I think Oliver Stone has unintentionally written quite a homoerotic figure between the two of them, because the harem scene that I mentioned where him and his men first invade Babylon and they steal the king's riches, among them are all the women of his harem. Alexander completely ignores all the women. He literally walks straight past them and makes a beeline to the only eunuch, the only man, male in the room, and starts off this conversation, this relationship with him. And there's a scene where Alexander has experienced this conspiracy amongst his own men. His own men have allegedly plotted to kill him. And among them is one of his oldest generals, Parmenion. And the scenes are intercut with he sent assassins to get rid of Parmenion. And as he's doing that, he's engaging in this sex scene. He's engaging in intercourse with the eunuch Bagoas. So as he's killing off the old Macedonians, his oldest friends, he's literally jumping into bed with the Persians, who would be the enemies. And it tells quite a disturbing story, I think, that as Alexander is sort of not losing his faculties per se, but as he becomes more reliant on drink, as he becomes more reliant on luxuries and lavishness, that sort of corresponds with his sort of mental degeneration. So we're getting the Persians are being associated with this degeneration, whereas the good Macedonians, who are, you know, wearing their armor, they're manly, they're not wearing the eyeliner, they've not been taken in by Persian dress, are getting killed off. And it's quite an interesting aspect of the film that is, that leaves me feeling a bit uncomfortable, but I think it's a very interesting thing. And I wonder if the film was made today, would those scenes have played out quite the same way that they did, or is it because it's a product of the mid-noughties? And I'm not quite sure I have an answer for it, but it's certainly something that I've been thinking about since watching it again and sort of noticing how these cuts are put together very deliberately. You know, the scenes where he's killing off the Greeks or the scenes he's jumping into bed with the Persians, quite literally, and that seems to contribute to his downfall. So I wonder what Oliver Stone's trying to say there. I don't know, but I don't think it was a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, it all is from the time too. I mean, I don't know how much better things are now, but they certainly weren't good back then, especially because of the war and, you know, like how it started, but then also just as it went on, like everything was just so dark when it came to Americanized interpretations of that part of the world. And so I definitely think it's a commentary being made, and, you know, not a good one, that like you say, it's so obvious the way that they're portraying the differences between his Greeks and his Persians. I think it's very interesting to look at Alexander in this way, because it's just a fascinating way to look at him historically while also looking at this movie, because I think it's a really easy but also particularly interesting way of learning about him in relation to this movie for its good and its bad. So thank you so much for giving me such a rundown on so much I didn't know about Alexander the Great and also this movie, which I don't know what I remembered it as, but I hadn't watched it since it came out. And then so watching it again was quite the experience, given I have seen Troy and 300 and all those other ones so many times. I hadn't seen Alexander more than once, but it was particularly interesting watching it again in this context of learning about the actual person, but also with everything that I know now, since obviously I hadn't done my degree or anything when I watched it first. So it's a very different experience now.
It's a good film in the sense that it takes you to places and makes you feel things, but it's also a frustrating film because, I mean, you're always going to be fighting a losing battle when you try and adapt Alexander the Great, because there's so many conflicting aspects to his character, and you're always going to have to make a decision to cut out some of the material somewhere. I think what I took from the film is that it is fascinating in the things that it does. I think I can find so many, it's a film that doesn't lack detail. It's just whether those details are going in the right direction. You know, I think, you know, it left me thinking all sorts of things, and I was making like notes and writing like 500 words on a ring, and I thought, oh my gosh, where am I getting all this from? But it's got so many things. I think what some of the merits of it is that you can sort of, it sends you down a lot of different rabbit holes. I think it's a flawed film in the sense that it doesn't give you a coherent picture because you don't know how you're supposed to feel starting and finishing. It starts with this massive battle where the stakes are so huge and you're like, wait a minute, I don't even know what they're fighting for. I don't even know what the purpose of this is. And then it finishes with his death, obviously, and this kind of very shocking little ending scene with Ptolemy kind of making this grand statement of, oh, you know, we killed him because he got too big for his boots and he reached too far. It's almost an Icarus moment, but God forbid they put any more mythology in it, my goodness. You're kind of left not knowing how to feel. You're kind of like, well, what is the lesson that I have learned? Have I learned not to overreach myself because that comes at the cost of my own humanity? Well, not really, because Colin Farrell's Alexander had no regrets by the end of it. Have I learned, you know, the problems of hubris? I don't know. I'm not quite sure what I've learned. So I think that's maybe the drawback of the film, but it certainly gives me plenty of ideas for how to do a film about Alexander and do it better. I'd love to, you know, direct or write or do something, my own version of Alexander. And I'd love to bring Colin Farrell back as Philip II. I think that would just be perfect. I think he's at the right stage of his career now. He could be a brilliant Philip II. That should be a nice little Easter egg. But I think it is a great experience to watch, I think, because visually it is stunning visually. I mean, the scene where he enters Babylon mm-hmm. with all the rose petals, it's fabulous. But it is a bit of an arduous undertaking. But then I wouldn't expect anything less from Alexander the Great.
It's very true. Very, very well summed up and perfect for that man, that character. Well, thank you so much for doing this, for talking to me about all of this. You're definitely the most well-versed on Alexander the Great that I've come across in my Twitter time and in just doing this podcast in general. So I very much appreciate you telling me all about him.
Thank you so much for listening. Finally, somebody who wants to talk about the film with me.
Oh, nerds, thank you all so much for listening to that. I had such a fun conversation with Meg. You can find her Twitter handle in the episode description for this. She is a wonderful follow on Twitter. That's how I met her and how this all came to be. I hope you all had an amazing holiday season. I hope you've all enjoyed this episode, this last of 2020, a perfect way to cap it off. I think we can all be glad this year is ending. With any luck, 2021 is going to be a better one. Happy New Year. I am Liv, and oh, how I love this shit.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy. And we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Leesa, the sleep experts. Here at Leesa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Leesa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Leesa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.